Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the sad, stunning end of the Space Shuttle Columbia and its seven-member crew left Americans and the world wondering why and how NASA's crown jewel could come to pieces in the sky. But as investigators dig in, a broader question is emerging as well. What exactly are we doing up there in space anyway? What is our big goal, our driving mission? And is the space shuttle the right tool or a dangerous, outdated pork barrel? In the early days of space travel, it was all about getting to the moon before the Soviets. Everybody was on board. Today, the mission is murky and hardly anybody is paying attention. Yet, in a poll conducted one day after the disaster, 82% of Americans said the U.S. should continue manned space flight. Tonight, On Point, rethinking the final frontier. Is America lost in space? Are you committed to space exploration? Why? What should the big goal be? And is it time to move beyond the shuttle? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Watertown, Massachusetts, Andrew Chaikin, a Morning Edition commentator and author of Man on the Moon. Good evening and welcome, Andy Chaikin.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be back.
Thanks for being here tonight, Andy. Also joining us from Stanford, California, Ted Postal, professor of science, technology, and national security at MIT. He's on sabbatical this year at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. Good evening and welcome back, Ted Postal.
I'm pleased to be here.
It's great to have you. Andy Chaikin, take us into the big, big question here first, and we're all going to be watching the continuing story of the Columbia disaster over the next couple of days. Tomorrow are the memorial services, and no one for a second doubts the courage and the national ambition invested in that seven-member crew. But what is it that is the big, overarching goal in space right now? I think for many people, once the shock began to subside, the question arose, what are we actually doing up there?
Well, you know, Tom, you've got me lulled into a position. You've actually got a space fanatic on the phone who is willing to agree with almost everything you said in your intro and say you're asking the right questions. What are we doing? And I think that the answer is we are kind of playing out momentum that began 30 years ago. It began when NASA did beat the Russians to the moon and said, well, okay, now we've done that, what do we do next? And NASA planners had many grand goals. They wanted to build a big space station in Earth orbit. They wanted to build a base on the moon. They wanted to send humans to Mars as early as the 1980s. And they wanted a reusable space shuttle to get people from here to there. The Nixon administration at that time said, no way, Jose, we've got environment problems, we've got inflation, we've got a war in Vietnam that we're trying to pay for, the country's tearing itself apart. Listen, we're not going to fund that stuff, but we're going to give you X amount of dollars. And NASA chose between its two sort of closest to home programs, the space station and the shuttle, came out with the shuttle. But what we ended up with was a shuttle that really was an amalgam of lots of different missions, to launch satellites, to retrieve satellites, to serve as a science platform in space, to even fly missions for the Department of Defense. The reason that the shuttle has those big wings is because it was a Department of Defense requirement. Well, you know, the shuttle got off and did a bunch of things, and then they came up with the space station. And you know how they justified that? They said it was the next logical step. But what I'm trying to say is that there really hasn't been a clear mission. Now, having said that, we need to give NASA a mission. NASA's an executive agency. It takes its orders from the top. I think the American public wants us to get back in the exploration business again. If the shuttle and the space station are doing good science, we need to hear about it. I think we need to hear why it's good science. But I think these are all questions that belong in a national conversation on space. It's something we've never done.
I expect that we are very likely to have that in the days and weeks ahead. And I want to be clear, Andy, you're a space fanatic, and there are many out there, and we're not here to throw cold water on space exploration or space science, but we're looking for some clarity about what the goal is. We're also going to be looking critically at the space shuttle tonight. But Ted Postol, first, at this top level, we sat around this afternoon playing a game of trying to describe in 10 or 20 words or less what America's goals are in space. We found we could not do it. What are they? What should they be?
Well, I don't know what they are, and I'm not sure I know what they should be, but I can tell you what the debate should be on. Mm. And I think Andy is exactly right. I mean, people have to decide how much of an objective we have for doing science, space science, and increasing our understanding of various scientific issues that can only be learned about by going into space.
This is specifically the zero gravity environment, or more than that?
No, it may be distant stars like mm-hmm. the Hubble telescope.
Of course,
or it may be understanding comets.
Mm-hmm.
It may be sending robot probes to Mars or Venus.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of scientific issues that people can study in space. Those don't necessarily require human payloads.
Mm-hmm.
Another objective, which needs to be thought about and discussed, is human travel in space. I think it's important not to mix up the role of developing capabilities and understanding of what needs to be done to use for humans to travel in space and the different science. I think one of the problems with the space shuttle has been that in order to justify sending people into space, there has been a lot of really quite silly scientific stuff done on the shuttle. And the shuttle has, in fact, been in part greatly justified because supposedly you need the shuttle to travel in space with humans. And none of these are true. In fact, you can have a very vigorous manned space program without a vehicle as complex as the shuttle, and it could actually be safer and scientifically more sound and bring us further to manned space travel if that's an objective of our country.
And we are going to look at the shuttle more closely, but still at this top level. Ted Postol, Andy Chaikin. Andy, I guess I hear you describing the shuttle as a kind of the shuttle period is kind of a holding pattern.
Well,
let me put it to you this way. What should that big goal be? When you describe exploration and science, are those two different things? Important to be going somewhere, or is it right that we should be in relatively near-Earth orbit, kind of fussing around with the experiments right now? Maybe that's all we're prepared to do at this point.
No, let me tell you what it comes down to. It comes down to access to low-Earth orbit. Once you get yourself that first 100 or 200 miles up there and you're in orbit around the Earth, you are in a position to do all kinds of things, whether it is build a Mars ship that takes humans to Mars or explore the heavens from above the atmosphere or look down at the Earth or do any one of a number of science experiments. Here is the crux of the problem.
Mm.
It still costs $10,000 a pound to put things in low Earth orbit and especially people.
Mm-hmm.
The shuttle was supposed to lower that cost by having an amazingly high flight rate. They were going to try to fly every other week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, science fiction. What we need is a vehicle that can lick that problem. It's a very difficult problem, but I think NASA's research and development expertise and the wonderful talent that they have should be focused on developing a vehicle that can actually carry people back and forth to low Earth orbit safely and reliably.
Ted Postol, speak to that.
Yes. Relatively less expensively, if that is possible.
One would hope so. Ted, I'm reading an essay today that will be out in the new Time magazine from Greg Easterbrook at the New Republic, and it is absolutely damning of the space shuttle. It says it's too expensive, it's too risky, it's too big for most of the ways it's used, and its massive budget sucks up funds that could be invested in a modern system that would make space flight cheaper and safer. It's really worse than that. Greg Easterbrook portrays the shuttle, which costs $500 million per flight, as a kind of giant pork barrel that Boeing and Lockheed Martin are invested in and won't let go of, that politicians from almost half a dozen states across the country that have large facilities are deeply invested in. He says it's way outdated. Its huge expense is standing in the way of us really pushing toward bigger, loftier, clearer goals. But there it sits, just sucking up resources. Is that a fair condemnation?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of truth to it, if not total truth. This is a problem with all big programs. If you get a very large program going, it always has an adverse effect on the research activities that are considered less central to the activity. The program managers get enormous amounts of power. They have large sums of money. There's never enough money, even when it's well-funded. And the tendency is for the money to get picked up from less central activities. So this is a well-known phenomena in big programs.
Is this the chance to act on it? Easterbrook says, cancel the space shuttle right now. Be done with it. And for that matter, he says, take apart NASA. It needs to be reorganized. It needs to have a clearer mission, and it needs to be disentangled from the kind of pork barrel politics. Too radical in your mind, Ted Postol, or the right path?
Well, I honestly don't know. I think it's a very radical suggestion when you look at the nature of American society and government. It's always nice to say take politics out of it, but as soon as you have large sums of money and vested interests, either careers or economic, you're going to have a lot of politics. My own view is that it would probably be better to focus on what makes the most technical sense given the objectives we set for NASA or for some organization that might follow NASA. We don't have clear objectives, and the technical sense associated with the space shuttle is not very good. We can, for example, build what is derisively called expendable launch vehicles. Mm-hmm. That are really have parts that are reused, just like the shuttle has parts that are reused, mm-hmm. that can be much more, have much higher payloads to orbit for the same size and weight that the shuttle type vehicle has, and can be, can provide a lot of protection for humans when they are carried on such a vehicle, and can also do all kinds of robotic launch missions when humans are not on the vehicle.
Are we developing such a vehicle? Is it on the drawing board?
Not at this time, but we certainly have developed vehicles like this. The Saturn V, which was an enormously successful launch vehicle, was a tremendous launch vehicle that launched payloads that were able to get into low Earth orbit and then travel onto the moon and then have...
It wasn't cheap, though.
I'm sorry?
It wasn't cheap, though. It was in that $10,000 per pound ballpark, if not a bit more.
But Andy Chaikin, Greg Easterbrook says, in financial terms and safety terms, no project has done more to harm space exploration than the space shuttle. He says no grand goal is possible while NASA relies on the super costly, dangerous shuttle.
I think that's something that people who love the space program have wrestled with for decades, and I think that there's some truth to that. It has sucked money out of other parts of what could have been other parts of the NASA budget. But I don't think you can just walk away from the shuttle because the space station, for one thing, if we don't complete the space station, we can't use it to do the science that NASA says will justify its cost and bring benefits. So I think that what we need to do is do the shuttle as much as we need to finish completing the station, do it as safely as we can, and then I'll give, if I were the head of NASA right now, or if I were the president, because really it has to come from the president, I would say this. Your goal, NASA, is to build a vehicle that can take 8 people, because you need a pilot and a co-pilot, mm-hmm. and then 6 station crew, mm-hmm. into low Earth orbit safely, reliably, and cheaply as possible. That is a well-defined engineering goal. It is not mixed in with all these other things that diluted the shuttle's goals. And that would open up the space frontier and allow many, many other things to happen.
So make it cheaper. But so far, we haven't heard that. There's a kind of natural instinct to stick with the thing.
No. They've tried. They've tried.
I think I'd like...
Ted Postol, please.
It's not possible to make a large vehicle that is so complex as cheap as a much less complex vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of this argument about a cost of per pound to orbit has to be looked at in the context of the bookkeeping that NASA has used to describe costs to people. I don't know what the actual cost to orbit is, but I don't think anybody knows when you look at the NASA budget. if you had a vehicle, let me just give you an example, just a common sense example.
Ted Postol, can you please hold the example? We've got to take a short break. We'll come right back and get it. We're talking tonight about America's goals in space. What are we doing up there? And is the shuttle the way to do it? You can join the conversation. Could you say, in 20 words or less, what NASA is trying to do? Why are we in outer space? What is the objective? Do we need humans in space to explore space? And when was the last time you watched a shuttle launch? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight, on the Monday after the Saturday of the Columbia tragedy, what are America's proper goals in space today? What are we doing up there? And is the space shuttle the way to do it? What's the right mission, the big goal? Ant farms in Earth orbit, stations on the moon, a city on Mars. Are we spending too much on NASA or not enough? And what if the space shuttle is a giant boondoggle, super expensive, out of date, and dangerous? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Ted Postol, Professor of Science, Technology, and National Security Policy at MIT, and Andy Chaikin, Morning Edition commentator and science writer, author of Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts. You're welcome to join us as well. Ted Postol, I had to interrupt. You were giving examples that spoke to this issue of cost and space flight, space exploration.
Well, I mean, there are lots of trade-offs here, and I think Andy is certainly correct in raising the questions about trade-offs. But let's just look at the space shuttle itself. And the vehicle itself weighs about 150,000 pounds, and let's, for the sake of discussion, say it's carrying a 50,000-pound payload to orbit. So what you're lifting is 200,000 pounds to orbit in order to place 50,000 pounds in orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're taking that 150,000 pounds, bringing it back to Earth. Of course, the claim is that it's now reusable, but there's a fantastic amount of effort made to make sure that this vehicle that's carrying a precious human target, human crew. Is going to function as it did on the last flight.
And as I understand it, we almost never take advantage of that 50,000-pound capacity anyway.
Well, we may well have a justification for a 50,000-pound payload or 150,000.
The Hubble telescope did.
Yes, the Hubble would have, but on the regular flights, as far as I know, often it's not near that.
Well, you could imagine, for example, launching pieces of the space station on a vehicle that could carry 200,000 pounds into orbit.
Can I just ask Ted directly? And I agree with everything you're saying is very well thought out and very appropriate. But I'm thinking of a vehicle. The shuttle is so big because it's supposed to carry up huge satellites that it no longer does mostly. What if we're just talking about a small vehicle that's not designed to stay in space for very long and is just supposed to be a ferry craft? Do you not think that could be built in a reusable fashion that would also be relatively inexpensive and reliable to operate?
I think it's a possibility. The Russians built a little space plane kind of device, and they launched it on a rocket, and you could a device like this could have many of the positive features that a capsule on a rocket can have, in the sense that you might be able to separate it from a rocket launcher if the rocket launcher failed and thereby recover the crew alive, or you might be able to transfer people from one location to another in space. So I don't disagree with you at all on that point.
And yet, Ted, as I understand it, it was just a few weeks ago that NASA canceled a program called the Space Launch Initiative. The goal was to design a much cheaper, more reliable replacement for the shuttle and announced that the shuttle fleet would remain in operation until 2020. This design, this fleet would be 40 years old by then.
Well, I think, and Andy may disagree with me, and I'd be interested to hear it. It seems to me that there is a fantasy and circus component to the way the space program has been pursued that really has a negative consequence for those who are truly interested in space science.
What do you mean by fantasy and circus component?
Well, let me just give you an example that's a little chilling. What if John Glenn were on this flight? What purpose does John Glenn have for going into space? Now, maybe it's nice. I mean, he's a great man in my view, But why is he going into space?
Celebrity space flight sort of thing.
Yeah. So it's a very dangerous game.
Mm-hmm.
I respect people who choose to play that game, but I think you shouldn't risk your life for just a freak show. A teacher shouldn't be killed on the Challenger.
We all respect the people who go up and who take the facilities they're given to help us reach into space, but we want to give them the right goal, the right facilities. And the question is whether we're doing that right now. Andy Chaikin, Ted Postol, please stand by. I want to turn to John Logsdon. He's joining us tonight from Washington. He's director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. He's author of The Decision to Go to the Moon, Project Apollo and the National Interest. Good evening and welcome, John Logsdon.
You know, coming out or right before your last break, you asked for a 20-word statement of what NASA is about.
Yes.
What the space program is about.
Yes.
Could I read you one?
Absolutely,
this,
please.
This is out of all things, a NASA phone book, but it's the statement of the NASA mission: to understand and protect our home planet, to explore the universe and search for life, to inspire the next generation of explorers.
John Logsdon, there it is. Does that capture it for you? And if it does, why is it that this mission has become fuzzy in the minds of many American citizens?
Well, I think we're paying the price of really bad decisions made 30 years ago after Apollo that said, I mean, the shuttle was originally conceived for one purpose, which was to carry people and cargo to a space station.
Mm-hmm.
The Nixon administration decided in 1970 not to build a space station, but allowed NASA to go ahead with the shuttle. And I think that was a deeply flawed decision.
Because that left the shuttle just tooling around in space without the full framework for its
use.
Well,
and it meant that you had to design a shuttle that was all things to all people. It was going to launch intelligence satellites. So it had a large payload bay. It also was going to be used to launch pieces of a space station when it was eventually improved.
Mm-hmm.
So it really affected the design of the station in ways that I think have contributed to the program's problems ever since day one.
John Logsdon, Andy Chaikin, Ted Postol, stand by. There's much more we want to hear, but a lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to turn to them. Tom's calling. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
That would be me.
Yes, that would be you, sir.
I'm Tom Benya from Somerville, Massachusetts. I'm a professor of astronomy at BU, and I'm a child of Sputnik.
Welcome. Good to have you. What's your view?
Well, I'd like to broaden the focus from why we may be in space and to why we ought to be in space.
Please do.
I think humankind ought to be in space for our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the reason for humankind to move into space is the enormous resources of the solar system and the enormous solar power available. We process rocks, asteroids from space with our technology, and the pollution stays in space. It's the future of our species, to me.
And do you mean our species traveling through the solar system or living elsewhere in the solar system?
I mean
system?
Living in the near-Earth environments to begin with, and then
mm-hmm.
you know, the 5,000 years of time since we built Stonehenge, mm-hmm. perhaps filling the solar system. But I think that's why we're there. I agree with everything my fellow colleagues have said tonight. It's a political issue in the short term, but indeed I think the shuttle needs to be replaced by something that is not all things to all people, but a single stage to orbit, small thing that has a more modest payload. It doesn't have to bring up big pieces, but smaller pieces, and it becomes more like an airline. People should. You know, not in spite of the tragedy, to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, people should say, okay, how many Apache helicopters have gone down compared to how many shuttles? They're both experimental, high-performance aircraft. People on the space shuttle are not on a 747 flying from New York to London.
They're certainly not, and we all respect and understand that. And really, this is not... there may be days ahead when there's hell to pay for what happened on the shuttle, but we know it comes with risks. But it just brings us back to wanting to have a clear national purpose. And you're saying, Tom, it is to eventually inhabit this solar system. Do you think we're on that path, or are we near it? Can we get to it?
Well, you know, 100 years ago, the United States of America spent 10% of its GMP building railroad infrastructure, and one could argue, I think, rather compellingly, that helped Western democracy win several wars.
Mm-hmm.
In the peak of NASA's funding, we got 4% of the GNP. It takes money to invest in the future, and the future of humankind is off-planet. The Earth is a spaceship. It's a rather big spaceship, but as Mark Twain said, invest in land, we're not making it anymore.
See, you got that right.
I think most people I think the country agrees with Tom, and I think obviously people who work at NASA agree with Tom. I am thinking back to that initial decision to build the shuttle and the Nixon White House saying to NASA, okay, go ahead and build the shuttle. And there was nobody to stop and say, wait a second, is that the best thing to do with the however many billions of dollars we've allocated? There was nobody to say, wait a second, let's try this a little bit more incrementally. John Logsdon, can you speak to whether or not the aerospace companies had their hooks into the Nixon administration and influenced that decision?
John Logsdon.
Well, first of all, you're not right in saying that there weren't alternatives. The President's Science Advisory Committee and the OMB were all designing shuttles in the summer of 1971, so there were lots of alternatives put forth. Why did the shuttle ultimately get approved as proposed? It did have a lot to do with politics. It had to be to do with Nixon being reelected in 1972, the cancellation of the supersonic transport in 71, and the need to get an aerospace program on the books for California and Texas, all kinds of parochial political reasons. It had nothing to do with a long-term vision of exploration.
John Logsdon, let me ask you about our caller Tom's vision of the purpose of our activity in space. He says, the future of humankind is off-planet. These are the baby steps toward that future. Do you share that vision,
well,
that understanding?
Notice he put a 5,000-year time frame on it.
It's a long time frame, we understand. But even with that, you want to be on the right track.
Yeah, and we have not been for 30 years. Humanity becoming a multi-planet species is kind of a cliche. I think that that's one possible path into the future. I mean, the problem is other places, at least in this solar system, are not very congenial to human life. At this point, we have to bring all the supplies, all the food, everything with us. So we have to get out there. We have to do the exploration. You know, the Lewis and Clark analogy isn't bad. To go out and see what's there and figure out what you want to do, whether you want to settle other places in space. So there's lots of steps to be taken before the ultimate colonization and space settlement. Mm. Maybe that's the future, but we have to go find out.
Tom, thank you for your call. Andy Chicken, let me put a naive question to you. I just don't know, but we've heard Sally Ride talk about building a space station, but building it on the moon. She's saying, look, this is where we should be headed. We've been there. It's the nearest big chunk of real estate out there. And let's go. Let's build it there. That's the real way forward.
Well, it's a great idea, and it certainly would get us back in the exploration business, but again, it comes down to cost. The reason we haven't been out of Earth orbit since the last Apollo mission in 1972 is because of that cost factor. That's why I think the problem that has to be solved as soon as possible is lowering the cost of access to low Earth orbit. Once you're in low Earth orbit, the energy requirements of going to the moon, especially if you can get up to, actually, I should not misspeak, if you can get up to, let's say, geosynchronous orbit where the communication satellites are, energy costs from there of going to the moon are pretty small. But the real, you know, the real hurdle is that first 150 miles and that first 17,500 miles an hour.
Ted Postal, the shuttle costs $500 million per flight. Just the bottled water that the crews use on board costs $500,000 a day, I read, while they're up there. Can we continue to support the space shuttle and leapfrog ahead to a new generation of vehicle that would let us move on?
Well, I'm not really qualified to answer that question, but I think probably not. My concern is that we have a very concrete and realistic assessment of what technology can support at this time. We certainly should not forget that there are other possibilities and try to push the boundaries there. But for example, I don't believe that the technology is in hand to build a single stage to orbit vehicle right now. I think the
But what if it's not single stage to orbit? What if it's two stages that are reusable? Why single stage to orbit? That's been kind of an elusive holy grail.
No, I'm not making an ideological statement. I'm making a technical statement.
Ted, could you just describe the single stage vessel for us? Meaning, it has its own fuel. It's part of the vessel. It all goes up at once.
The basic system, and there are many concepts of it, is that you take advantage of air, and so because a rocket propellant needs an oxidizer, mm-hmm. and so you have a very complicated engine that becomes a ramjet and then reconfigures to become a scramjet and then eventually flies to high enough altitude and where there's not enough oxygen to use, and then you go to a fully rocket-propelled vehicle. And when you do all the arithmetic of the what you can carry to orbit, assuming that you can take advantage of the atmosphere at these lower altitudes, you come up with a vehicle that has a very favorable-looking payload to orbit.
And, Ted, does it not have the giant tube of fuel that we're accustomed to seeing dropping off as things go into space?
It may look like anything. I mean, typically the diagrams you see of it is some exotic-looking, supersonic-looking type of airplane. Mm-hmm. But nobody really knows how to build this kind of thing because the materials, the demands on the temperature that these materials in the engine and in the pieces of this vehicle would be subjected to, and the strength these materials must maintain under these high aerodynamic heating loads, are not achievable with today's materials. This is not to say it can never be done. It's simply to say that the technology, the science-based materials technology, is not yet in hand. We should be working on the technology for this.
Could I put in a reality check to this?
John Logsdon, please.
Okay. First of all, the United States NASA spent over $1 billion from 1995 through the early 2000s on a program called X-33 mm-hmm. that was intended to do a lot of the things that Ted was just talking about, and it turned out to be too hard. So mm-hmm. I agree with him. We do not have the technology mm-hmm. in hand. Just last fall, Sean O'Keefe and his associates looked at the state
the
of
NASA
technology
head.
And mm-hmm. said it's still too hard. Mm-hmm. And that's why they moved their investment to the shuttle and a shuttle alternative, which is not advanced technology. It's the kind of thing that Andy was talking about, just a small thing called the orbital space plane, just to take people back and forth. So we underinvested for a long time in technology, mm-hmm. and we're paying the price of that.
Ted Postol, I know we've only got you for 40 seconds more. What is your very personal vision of where we ought to be headed, what our ultimate goal is? Is it humanity off-planet?
Well, I guess my feeling is that the ultimate goal is much too far ahead for me to see. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I were sitting in the United States 200 years ago and imagined that I'd be, you know, you'd travel between California and the East Coast and, you know, you'd have this fantastically developed society, it would have been well beyond my imagination. Mm-hmm. So I try to think of things that I believe are within our grasp that don't foreclose other options. And my own view is that we should emphasize improving our knowledge of the space environment and space science, and also improve our understanding of how people can survive in space and travel in space. And I quite honestly don't see that a shuttle is critical to that. And I think you might even be able to do more than what we've been doing if you reorganize the program into a technologically more sound configuration.
Ted, we've got to go. I know we have to lose you. Ted Postol of MIT, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's goals in space. What are we doing up there, and is the shuttle the way to do it? What's your big vision of our proper goal in space? Are we on that track? And what if the space shuttle is a giant boondoggle, super expensive, out of date, and dangerous? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight by Andy Chaikin, a Morning Edition commentator and science writer, and by John Logsdon, director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. And right now, Don's calling from Atkinson, New Hampshire. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to first comment on the single stage to orbit discussion that you folks were doing.
This, the notion of something that would take off and go right on up.
It would be just like an airplane. You mm-hmm. don't, you know, the airplane doesn't discard parts as it's flying from Boston to, you know, California. It gets fueled, it flies, lands, and refuels and comes back.
Realistic or dream, Don?
I think it's realistic. What the other guest from MIT wasn't talking about, he was talking about the air-breathing version of this. Mm-hmm. There was another concept called the DCX and DCXA, which successfully flew under a military and NASA program. That was a start on that process, but the Clinton administration killed the follow-on vehicle, which would have been the DCY.
But our guest John Lockton's saying, hey, let's have a reality check. This, we've looked into it, and we're not there yet. If we want to be in space, that's not a viable option now.
Let me finish the discussion here. The X-33 was a make-work project for the NASA centers. It was the down-select process was interfered by the Clinton administration. I won't mention the names inside the vice president's office that did this, but the team that did the DCX was disqualified, you know, as part of that project, and it went to the weakest company in the group, which happened to be the ones that did the VentureStar.
Don, stand by. I want to get John Lockton's thoughts here.
Well, complicated set of thoughts. And the DCX was a way of demonstrating that you could control a spacecraft with just a few people on the ground. Mm-hmm. It could only go up a few thousand feet. It wasn't going anywhere near space.
On the ground, but it would be manned?
No.
Or not? I see.
No,
not.
It was not a crewed spacecraft. Mm-hmm. I try not to say manned. Consciousness has been raised.
Yes, it has. A lot of sacrifice.
The DCY was one of the contenders, along with a shuttle-like thing that Rockwell proposed, and the VentureStar that Lockheed proposed in this competition for the next big investment. Rather, you know, we can argue whether it's the weakest contractor. It was the most technologically ambitious of the programs proposed, and maybe therein lie its fault. I think there were some claims made by the Lockheed management at the time of what they could do that had no relation to reality.
John, let me turn back to our caller, Don. What's your view on whether we can have the space shuttle and the funds to invest in the next generation at the same time? Should we take Greg Easterbrook's advice, drop the space shuttle right now, and get to work, even if it takes a decade to produce its successor?
Well, what I really think should happen is we should let the marketplace do this. Right now, you know, we have central planning from NASA that's basically picked one concept, you know, like the VentureStar, which was, you're right, the technologically most challenging, but I'd also say it was the weakest proposal of them because it didn't have a chance of flying. It became a hangar queen.
But what would be the driving impetus for private space exploration and science? Would it line up with the national interest naturally or not?
Well, one way to do it is to change the way space is funded. Right now, a researcher at a university, you know, wants to do something in space or further his research, goes and presents paper and jumps through all the hoops and gets in good graces with someone over at NASA that gives him some money so he can go fly it on their hardware, where if the researcher is really that important, you'd give the researcher $50 million and say, here, go build your hardware at the contractors you want to use. Go, if you want to buy a ride and you want to save some money, go use the Russians.
I wonder, Don, though. I mean, some of these are very long horizon research projects we're talking about, but you've given us a lot of food for thought. Don, thanks for your call. Andy Chaikin, is there a role for more private enterprise here?
There's a role for more private enterprise where there is demand, but, you know, the problem has been that we haven't seen the space age equivalent of the gold rush. There really isn't a growth industry in space other than communication satellites. I mean, even space tourism, really, at $20 million a ticket, even if you had everybody on a shuttle paying for their ride, you wouldn't be able to pay the cost of a space mission. The only reason the Russians can do it, and John would understand this better than me, is the way the economics of their program works. Something about the hard currency maybe goes a little further, or maybe
super
they're just
valuable there.
Yeah, but I think that space flight is still extremely difficult, and it's something that governments still have to help happen. We're not at the DC-3 stage. We are somewhere before the male pilots of the 1920s. We're somewhere between the Wright brothers and the male pilots of the 20s. We need government help to develop the technology to lower that cost so that then fine. You can get up there and see what's profitable, see what kinds of materials you can develop. But it ain't going to happen unless we lower that cost.
We're still barnstorming. Jay's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Sure. My question, and I think this is the biggest challenge for NASA and maybe in the president justifying the cost, is producing hard benefits, hard an actual end to this program. You know, I think NASA, in a lot the eyes of a lot of people, myself included, has been giving a clean slate, sort of a free pass to do whatever research they see fit, because they've got, you know, they've got PhDs behind them and, you know, a ton of technology and, you know, experts behind them. What are the hard results? And I think that's going to be the challenge, is convincing the public, you know, this influences your daily life, be it medical, technological, communications.
But is it?
I'm curious to see how that's going to be developed.
But Jay, is that what we really want? I mean, when Christopher Columbus sailed to the New World, he didn't bring back much that really changed people's daily life on those expeditions. But in the end, it changed the world. Doesn't the same thing apply to space somehow?
I think we've maxed out the borders of Earth, though, and it's a big step to space, and I tend to be a little bit skeptical in seeing quite the exact comparison. I mean, it's certainly the educational and inspirational value in pushing our edges and exploring boundaries is that's very beneficial. But maybe this crash of the Columbia is kind of raising our ears and making us a little bit more skeptical.
Jay, thanks for your call. John Logsdon, how about it? Where should we be focusing our energy and expectations?
Can I first go back very quickly to the previous caller?
Mm-hmm.
There is one thing, and Andy didn't mention, a thing called the XPRIZE, which is modeled on the prize that Lindbergh competed for, first across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And it says if a team can design a vehicle to get people 50 miles up, not into orbit, but 50 miles up and back safely, and do it again in 2 weeks, that they win $10 million. There are supposedly 27 teams competing with that, some of them with their funding in place.
That's a lot of energy.
So there is a private sector activity aimed at beginning the process of developing a privately funded path to space.
And to Jay's observation that this sentiment, this feeling that we've maxed out the kind of shuttle effort and we need hard results now, is that possible? Or are we still, as Andy says, in such early days that we have to just probe and probe patiently?
No, I mean, we're on the way to building the facility. We're three-quarters of the way or two-thirds of the way through of the laboratory that will begin to produce hard scientific results. That's the space station. That's why this is so tragic, not only for loss of life and the impact of the program, but also the delays in finishing space station so we can begin to use it. That will produce good science, results that will improve life on Earth.
I want to challenge you on that, John. I want to know how you can say that with confidence. And I speak as somebody who spent my life supporting the space program. But when NASA says, let us build the space station and let us just get up there and we will do things that will knock your socks off, I personally am still waiting to hear that is going to happen. And I understand that the space station can't do all of most of the science. The station has to be completed, which is why we can't throw the shuttle away.
Andy Chaikin, with that, we're going to have to leave it. But you raise exactly the challenge that brings us right back to the beginning. We're going to have to come back to this space issue. What is it about that next step? How do we define it to bring the country along? Andy Chaikin, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Andy Chaikin is an NPR Morning Edition commentator and science writer, author of Man on the Moon. And John Logsdon, thanks for joining us from Washington tonight.
Okay, thank you.
John Logsdon is director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, students in Israel mourn the loss of a hero. This is On Point. The Columbia space shuttle disaster hit hard among students at the Oort School in Kiryat Motzkin, Israel. 34 of the school students were selected by NASA to design an experiment that the Columbia crew carried out before its mission came to its tragic end. The students spent the last 4 years working on that experiment, which examined the effect of zero gravity on crystal growth. They had worked with Israel's first astronaut, Ilan Ramon, who became a role model for them. Five of the students went to Colorado 2 years ago for a simulation of the Columbia flight and the experiment. Five other students went to Florida to watch the Columbia's launch last month. Marga Sigal is headmaster of the Ort School. In this radio diary, she says her students are struggling to cope with the loss of a hero.
When the tragedy started, it catch everybody in another place. But very quick, in about 1 hour, students just felt the need to get together. So we met in one of the apartments of one of our students. And students started to come over there, and some cried. Some other started with speculation. Maybe there is a chance that the astronauts are still alive. But they are students that studied the subject, so they knew that there is no chance. The next day, early in the morning before school started, students started to come to school with a lot of photos, some of them from their own photos that they took in the States, some other with pictures that they load down from the internet, from the NASA web. It was really spontaneous. They built a memorial corner with all these pictures, letters, and so on, and a lot of candles. A lot of people are talking about, well, it's not worse, why don't we finish our problems on the Earth? And you know, in Israel, we have enough problems. But the kids are talking about reaching out in the space or in any other field of science, pure science. This is the only way that really a nation and maybe the whole world can come forward. So they came to us, to their teacher and to the management, and asking us to try to continue this kind of project. Ilan Ramon was for a lot of our students a role model, and they wanted to find a way to commemorate his memory but not to stop his work. We have the last 2 years very difficult situation here in Israel. And this story about Ilan, about his being a part of such a wonderful group, feeling wonderful with his friends, the other astronauts, it was something that made us feel very good in the last weeks. Nobody expected that something bad will this time happen. Some of us just saw that, well, we had enough with tragedies in this country, so it shouldn't have happened in space, because really, over there at least, we saw that it's, I don't know, it should be another world. And this is some of the students that, some of them that were in different occasion close to situation of bombs and explosion and so on, they say to me that, well, this time it shouldn't have happened. We have it enough on Earth here in Israel.
Marga Sigal is the headmaster of Ort High School in Kiryat Motzkin, Israel. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by